the Vikings. Over 1,000 years ago, these fearsome warriors invaded Britain, Ireland, and other parts of the world. They were masters of trade, exploration, and colonization. The Vikings still beguile and fascinate us today, but few know the story of one of their greatest dynasties, founded around 850 AD by a mighty king called Ivar. Ivar and his descendants built an empire in the North Atlantic. These Vikings brought chaos to the lands they invaded. But their contributions to trade, society, and culture became mainstays of society. The battles they fought decided the fate of Northwest Europe for centuries to come. And now, science suggests they may have saved one country from disaster. There are many sides to the Viking story, but a most unexpected one emerged only recently. In Queen's University Belfast, scientists analyzed thousands of archaeological samples from all over Ireland. They aimed to reveal the big picture trends that shaped the country. The research suggests something extraordinary. In early medieval times, Ireland suffered a devastating catastrophe. In this scenario, the Vikings may have helped rescue an entire society. And in doing so, they left a signature that endures to the present day.
We see a Scandinavian component in the genomes of modern-day Irish people, and this is seems to be specifically Norwegian.
But in 902 AD, it seemed the Viking presence in Ireland would be cut short. By this time, many Vikings had settled down in Ireland, founding harbors and communities in coastal areas. The most powerful group were descendants of the ruthless king, Ivar.
He was the progenitor of a Viking empire. And that's why the grandsons of Ivar are feared so much, because Ivar himself is considered such a huge monumental figure.
Ivar's grandsons controlled the main Viking settlements, including the Kingdom of Dublin. The Irish called them the Dark Foreigners. In 902 AD, the Irish hit back at the invaders. The kingdoms of Brega and Leinster attacked Dublin and won a crushing victory.
We've got really vivid chronicle narratives of the time telling us how the Vikings were driven out and they escaped half broken and half dead across the sea.
The victorious Irish took control of Dublin. For the dynasty of Ivar, it was a devastating setback. Their achievements and ambitions lay in tatters. Ivar's grandsons passed long years in exile in Britain and France. The most senior of them may have been Sitric Ceach, Sitric the One-Eyed. Like his grandfather Ivar, Sitric was a tough and resolute leader. He was determined to one day return to Ireland. In 917, 15 years after the defeat of the Vikings, the Irish witnessed strange omens.
Snow and extreme cold and unnatural ice this year. Horrible portents also. The heavens seemed to glow with comets, and a mass of fire appeared with thunder in the west beyond Ireland, and it went eastwards over the sea.
In that same year, the monks of St. Mullen's Monastery experienced a sudden interruption to their daily routine. The monastery's location on the River Barrow in southeast Ireland gave it easy access to the outside world. But this also exposed it to Viking attackers, who'd already plundered it 3 times. And now, it seemed they would do so again. Because incoming on the river were Viking ships. Their commander was Cidric Chaoch himself.
If you actually were to be standing by the banks of the Barrow and witnessing the sight of what would have been a royal fleet coming up the Barrow, launching itself and landing, which must have struck terror into anybody's heart if they saw these things, because they knew that absolute vengeance and bloodshed was heading their direction.
15 years before, the men of Leinster had driven Cidric out of Dublin. Now, he had a chance to settle the score. Irish warriors were on the march nearby, led by Ogier, the King of Leinster. Dr. Gavin Hughes is an expert on this critical episode in the wars between Vikings and Irish.
Some people think that Ogier knew that the army of Cidric was here and went deliberately to engage him. And then the Vikings were very clever in this respect, as they avoided pitched battles if they could. I think they probably saw the opportunity of Ogier's army marching past and they thought, right, we can take them on.
Today, this small river valley near St. Mullins looks peaceful and picturesque. But 1,100 years ago, it was drenched in chaos and carnage. Because this is where Cidric attacked the men of Leinster.
Then it would have been a free-for-all.
The fight was over, many men lay dead. Most of them were Irish. The Vikings had the victory.
There would have been bodies floating in the water, probably have turned red. What is so important about the battle that happens here, Cidric's warriors go straight into Leinster. They push on up to Dublin.
With the army of Leinster annihilated, Dublin was defenseless. 15 years after he was driven out of the settlement, Cidric returned in triumph. Once again, the dark foreigners were in control of Dublin, and they had ambitious plans. They created a carefully planned Viking town. Almost 50 years ago, this place re-emerged into daylight for the first time in centuries. In the 1970s, at Wood Quay on the Liffey's south bank, builders began work on new offices for Dublin Corporation. What no one realized was that just a few feet beneath the surface, an ancient town lay buried. Digging soon revealed the remains of the original Viking settlement. It was an opportunity to unearth the earliest lair of the city. 25-year-old archaeologist Pat Wallace was put in charge of the archaeological excavation. What he discovered was breathtaking. A unique blueprint for what a 10th century European town looked like.
We know more about Dublin in the 10th century and early 11th than we do of any other town in Northwest Europe, even London and Paris. We have a clearer view of the plot layout, the pathway widths, how plots were used, the types of building, where buildings were located, all of that over several layers than we have of any other Northwest European town.
The Vikings also fundamentally changed architecture in Ireland. Before they arrived, Irish architecture had one overwhelming feature: roundness. But the Vikings introduced a whole new way of building. Adjoining Wood Quay and along the edge of Fishamble Street, Pat uncovered the remains of their houses.
One of the major physical legacies of the Vikings in Dublin is the establishment of the rectangular form of building as the ordinary domestic house. 75% of all the buildings in Dublin were rectangular in form. They gave us our towns, our first real mainstream European towns with town plots, town layouts, a consistent building type inherited over the ages, consistent positioning of property, all of that, defended towns.
Thanks to the Wood Quay excavations, we know more about how Viking Dublin was built than any other Viking town outside of Scandinavia. But a town is more than its architecture. The archaeologists also uncovered the remains of craftworks, jewelry, weapons, and food, along with human and animal remains. These finds allow us to see Viking Dublin as a living, breathing place. A place where sanitation was rudimentary, where the smells of dirt and offal mingled with livestock and food, where people traded human flesh alongside finely crafted products. A vibrant and savage place where criminal justice equaled iron, blood, and death.
If you can imagine coming in on a helicopter over Viking Dublin, what would you see? Your first impression would be the straw thatch roof with smoke coming up towards the smoke hole. No chimneys, but a hole in the thatch to let out the smoke. And then there'd be mud. You'd be looking at mud in different states of dryness. The estuary would be a gooey, brown, oozy mud.
I like to imagine 10th century Dublin as a town made of wood. And that's how it would have appeared to a person walking around the streets of Dublin or even entering from the quayside.
If we were to be able to step back in time and just walk around the Viking settlement of Dublin, it would really strike us as very different in a number of different ways. One would be, it would be really small. The other thing that I think, as you know, 21st century people, that we would notice straight away is the smell. I think it would be an assault on our senses in a way that, you know, walking in a modern Western city is not.
Small though it was by our standards, this fledgling city was an epicenter of global trade.
At this stage, this is what you're starting to see, is people who are doing craft working and industry using imported raw materials from the Baltic and the North Atlantic sea trade. And they're turning them into commercial goods
that can be sold out of the port of Dublin. Certain houses were amber working centres. Now, amber obviously isn't native to Ireland. It's brought from the Baltic by the sea trade. They were making beads and amulets and artefacts that would have been sold on then to other markets.
Just like in a modern city, the inhabitants of Viking Dublin paid attention to their personal appearance.
They were very sophisticated, and we could tell that from the clothes that they wore. You know, we find fragments of woven woolen garments, of silks coming from the Far East, of leather shoes that are beautifully manufactured. They wore their wealth in their jewellery and in their clothes.
Viking Dublin pulsated with life, and yet sometimes death came suddenly and dramatically. Because the town dispensed rough justice.
You'd be walking in an environment where there could be body parts stuck around the periphery of this settlement.
Hidden beneath the ground where the town's ramparts once stood, archaeologists found a jumble of human skulls. Bioarchaeologist Dr. Barrow Donovan is an expert on human remains and what they tell us about their owners. In the National Museum of Ireland's Conservation Unit, he examines the skulls.
We have the remains of 17 individuals, and these are all skulls, and in some cases skulls and some of the bones of the neck. And in about 50% of the 17, we have evidence, direct evidence, of blade injuries.
Barra believes that the heads once stood high on wooden posts over the ramparts.
So in terms of these 17 individuals whose heads ended up displayed on the ramparts, the big question is, who were they? You know, it's absolutely possible that some were inhabitants of the Viking town who might have identified with the kind of Viking population, but had somehow come to offend those in power. And they end up being executed. So there's pretty strong evidence that that's what we're dealing with these heads. These were trophies placed around the ramparts of the city.
It could be that some were local people who intermingled with the Vikings.
One of the ways in which we've looked at that is to look at the stable isotope signature of their teeth, because you are what you eat. The chemical makeup of the teeth reflects where you grew up. And that has given us equivocal results that most seem to be local to the hinterland of Dublin. Now, whether that means they're insiders or outsiders in the context of 10th century Dublin, that's a very difficult question to answer because, you know, Dublin was very much a melting pot. You had a mixture of immigrant Vikings, but then you also have the local population mixing.
We will never know exactly what crimes might have motivated the executions. We do know that the Vikings cherished their jewelry and other valuables. Above all, one precious metal entranced them, silver. The Vikings traded goods far and wide, and in return, silver flooded into Ireland from the outside world.
The silver is the main barometer of wealth in Dublin and in Ireland in the Viking Age. And we have different types of Irish metalworking traditions and art and design impinging on Viking silver. We find silver hoards all over Ireland. There are over 100, some with coins.
Some hoards are connected with unusual and mysterious places.
Do
Dunmore Cave is a limestone grotto formed over 300 million years ago. It contains some of the most spectacular cave formations anywhere in Ireland. From ancient times, the cave had a reputation as an ominous and forbidding place.
It's a very liminal space. It's very different to the rest of the world above. When you walk through the mouth of the cave, it's like crossing a threshold into an underworld. And that naturally conjures up certain kind of beliefs and certain kind of concerns, should we say. It's recorded as one of the three darkest places in Ireland. There was a guy writing in the 18th century, and he described entering into the cave as like walking into the mouth of a wild beast with 10,000 teeth above your head and 10,000 more below your feet.
Despite, or maybe because of the cave's sinister aura, over 1,000 years ago, someone used it for safekeeping. In 1999, this shadowy crevice yielded a treasure trove.
It consisted of around about 43 different objects. There was coins that came from the Saxon kingdoms in England. There was a small thread of silk that came from a very high status garment, perhaps a headscarf or something like that. There was also buttons with silver wire, which were quite unusual and very, very interesting.
These are actually for a cloak. They're kind of knitted wire, silver wire. Now this is the biggest size, but there were smaller ones. These would have been plucked from a cloak. Very valuable cloak, probably worn by a very rich town person.
Most likely the cloak's owner was a wealthy Viking, but it's unlikely that this person stashed the buttons in the cave. Instead, it seems someone else hid the silver for another purpose.
Was it a founder's hoard, somebody who was going to melt it down and turn it into silver ingots? Because silver ingots, the handiest way of transporting silver for a merchant or for a tradesman.
If so, this merchant must have traded something in return for the items. The Vikings continued to operate a massive international trade in slaves. And for it, they needed a steady supply of captives.
The Irish kings saw that opportunity and bought into it. So they sold the slaves from their enemies to the Norse to be sold abroad. The silver that we find is probably as a result of selling slaves to the Norse for profit.
Through both trade and raids on settlements, the Vikings had taken many captives. To stop these prisoners from escaping, they needed a secure location. Overlooking the southern fringes of Dublin Bay, Dalkey is one of Ireland's most affluent suburbs. It even has its own offshore retreat, the small and picturesque Dalkey Island. But when the Vikings controlled this area, the inhabitants were anything but rich.
The etymology of the name Dalkey is quite interesting in itself. So the Irish sources in the 8th century record it as a place called Delganish. So Delg, Irish for thorn, and Inish, Irish for island. And that was then adopted as a place name by the Norse as Dork, thorn, and Oi, or A, island. So that's the origin of the place name.
The Vikings used this place for a very specific purpose. Archaeologist Ruth Johnson believes it's all to do with its setting.
could describe Dolci Island almost like the Viking Alcatraz. It was a place where slaves were brought and held, probably only for a very short period of time prior to being taken to the slave market at Dublin. Well, Dolci Island was the perfect location, really, for holding slaves captive. It's about 300 metres from Dolci Harbour. Now, that sound is extremely treacherous, so it would have been very hard to swim across that sound as a captive. I think as an Irish slave, as somebody who had been brought here on ship, it would have been terrifying.
The Vikings did not introduce slavery to Ireland, but they did bring it to another level. With their large harbors and huge fleets, they had the infrastructure to run a global trade in human flesh. The slave routes stretched eastwards to Russia and the Middle East and northwards into the Atlantic. As the slaves moved, so did their masters. A new DNA study plots how Viking genes spread throughout Europe.
In 2020, we had a huge study that aimed to basically characterize the genetic impact of the Viking Age in Scandinavia itself and on Europe more broadly. Scandinavia at this time, it's a very dynamic place. Scandinavia is really becoming more and more connected with the rest of the world. We are getting outward movement, gene flow from Scandinavia into the rest of Europe. Westwards, we have the movement of Norwegian-like populations. We see influxes in Orkney, Scotland.
The most remote of these places was a land of fire and ice that remained uninhabited until the 9th century. Around 871 AD, the Vikings decided to colonize Iceland, but they could not do so on their own.
There is a cultural memory of Ireland that Iceland maintains into the High Middle Ages, which would suggest that the Irish had a strong presence in Iceland at the founding.
An old Icelandic saga hints at the nature of this presence. Written down some 800 years ago, it describes events said to have taken place in the 10th century. One of the saga's characters is a Viking merchant named Höskuldr. He travels from Iceland to Scandinavia, where he meets a Russian slave trader. The Russian shows Höskuldr some female slaves he is up for sale. Then he reveals his most prized captive, one whom he values at 3 times the price of the others. Höskuldr is so impressed that he buys her on the spot and brings her back to Iceland. Her name is Melkorka, and she turns out to be an Irish princess, captured in a raid and sold into bondage. She later bears a son who travels to Ireland and meets his grandfather.
Now, we have to remember the sagas are medieval Icelandic literature. They're not primary contemporary sources, but they do keep the oral tradition of the Viking Age.
Although a saga character, Melkorka is probably based on a real person. And now, science confirms that many other women shared her fate.
A genetic study has recently been conducted that looked at the bones of the early Norse settlers in Iceland. And what they found is that over 60% of the women who settled in Iceland came from the British Isles. The patrilineal DNA suggests that over 60% of the men came from Norway. Now, what this means is that the Norse brought female Irish and British slaves to Iceland with them, whether that be as concubines or as slaves who worked the earth.
It was a very sad fate for any young, attractive woman that fell into the hands of the Vikings, because they literally would be just traded away. You get women that are trapped, if you like, because of who they are, you know, that they're at their high political status, and then you get the women that are trapped at the lower end of the scale as well. So I don't think it was a very good situation to be in. Families were split up, so the women, you know, were separated from their children, they're separated from their husbands. You can guess what the fate that awaited some of them.
The dynasty of Ívar may have masterminded this program of mass slavery and transportation to a foreign land.
We don't have direct contemporary evidence of the involvement of the dynasty of Ívar in the settlement of Iceland, but what we do know about the settlement of Iceland was that a lot of people did come from Britain and Ireland and were part of the settlement. It's certainly the case that some of these must have been traded as slaves.
By 930 AD, the descendants of Ívar controlled many Viking settlements in Ireland and Britain. In Dublin and Waterford, they were all powerful. They also dominated York and the Kingdom of Northumbria. But here, they faced a new threat, the Anglo-Saxon king, Æthelstan. Deep in the Wirral Peninsula in northwest England, an old country manor stands amid elegant gardens. This is Poulton Hall, ancestral home of the Llansillan Green family since 1093. In the gardens, the metal face of a bearded warrior peers from the foliage. He evokes the time-worn links between this place and the Vikings. Dominga Devitt is a member of Wirral Archaeology, based here at Poulton Hall. The group explores the Wirral Peninsula's Viking heritage, because the nearby fields hold secrets that are only now being uncovered.
A large part of our work is the search for the site of the Battle of Brunanburh. We do have a firm belief that the battle was fought on the Wirral Peninsula, and we totally understand the massive importance of finding the site where the battle was fought will be where the birth of the nation of England happened.
Fought in 937 AD, the Battle of Brunanburh was a winner-takes-all struggle for the fledgling nation of England. The seeds of the battle were sown over a decade earlier, when the Anglo-Saxon monarch Æthelstan set out to bring all of Britain under his rule. At this time, Sitric Caoch, the Viking king who had wrenched Dublin back from the Irish, ruled Northumbria from its capital, York. When Sitric died in 927, Æthelstan took the opportunity to capture York.
Æthelstan was trying to basically create an English kingdom. There was no unified kingdom of England before his reign, and he brings Northumbria under his control. So obviously this creates enemies. The creation of this unified English kingdom isn't, of course, seen as a threat by neighboring peoples.
In 934, in a show of strength, Æthelstan marched his army north into the kingdom of Strathclyde and on into Scotland. The local rulers, Owain of Strathclyde and Constantine of Scotland, were powerless to stop him. In that same year, Olaf Guthfridsson, a great grandson of Ívar, became the Viking King of Dublin.
All of these groups, Constantine of Scotland, Owain of Strathclyde, and the Vikings of Dublin, all have a vested interest in Northumbria. These three kings had suddenly much more interest in common to defeat Æthelstan.
On their own, neither Olaf, Constantine, or Owain could beat Æthelstan. But together, they might just have a chance. Sometime around 937, the three kings agreed to join forces and invade England. United for the first and only time, Olaf, Constantine, and Owain knew this was their best chance to defeat Athelstan. In Dublin, the Viking king assembled an army, a mixture of Viking and native Irish warriors. The Dublin warriors set sail in their ships. This wasn't the last army Ireland sent to invade England, but it was the last one to have any chance of success. The Viking ships joined up with fleets from Strathclyde and Scotland, creating a huge armada.
The records that we have suggest the fleet could have been over 600 ships, which would have been massive by the standards of the time. And I think we can all in our minds kind of imagine how that could have looked and how dramatic and intimidating that would have seemed.
There's no consensus on where the fleet landed or where the Vikings and their Scottish allies met the Anglo-Saxon forces. But many believe it was somewhere here on the Wirral Peninsula.
The place name Brunanburh in the Wirral fits quite well with the place name Brunanburh, which is recorded in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, which is our earliest historical narrative of the events in 937. This area was settled by Hiberno-Scandinavians. So it would have been a sympathetic region for an invading army to come to. This area is also very geographically accessible from Dublin.
Recent discoveries in the Wirral support the idea that the battle was fought here. Investigating a field not far from Poulton Hall, Wirral archaeology unearthed some intriguing finds.
We found an arrowhead which has been identified as typical of 10th century Viking arrowheads. And we've discovered a really interesting thing, which is an Islamic silver coin called a dirham. This was a very popular coin amongst Vikings because they valued it for its high silver content. And it's often found in areas of Viking occupation or where the armies have passed through.
It's quite difficult, given the dating range that can be assigned to these finds, to say, oh, they all belong to 937. But there is a kind of plausible context, but I think this work is still in its infancy.
The research continues, and one day it may confirm that the Battle of Brunanburh was fought in this area. But wherever the battle took place, one thing is certain. It was a ferocious encounter. Dawn broke over a field that would soon be dark with blood. Swords, axes, and shields crashed together incessantly. All day long, the fighting continued. None could say who would be victorious.
The coalition force, the invaders, probably had a strategic advantage, and indeed the early stages of the battle might have gone quite well for them. But whatever happened, suddenly the battle fell in Athelstan's favour.
In the waning light, the Anglo-Saxons pushed forward. Their enemies fled for their ships, but many never made it that far. The bodies of the slain covered the field. The greatest battle yet fought on English soil was over. It could have gone either way, but the Anglo-Saxons had the victory. Viking hopes of dominating England lay trampled into the bloody soil.
They left behind to share the corpses, the dark-coated one, the Black Raven, and that gray beast, the Wolf of the Wood. Never greater slaughter was there on this island. Never more folk felled before this, by the sword's edges.
The victory cemented England's place as the dominant nation in Britain and Ireland. The Vikings, Irish, and Scots withdrew to the periphery, and there they would remain. But had they been victorious, history would have been very different.
If Olaf and his allies had been victorious, I think that would have shored up this Viking kingdom of Northumbria. Then it could have consolidated the power of the Vikings of Dublin in Northern England, and theoretically, the Kingdom of England, in its current geographical boundaries, would never have happened.
Never again would the dynasty of Ivar pose the same threat to the Anglo-Saxons. In 954 AD, they withdrew from mainland Britain. Gradually, almost all Vikings converted to Christianity. Around 1030, Sitric Silkbeard founded Christ Church Cathedral overlooking the Viking town of Dublin. Sitric was a descendant of Ivar, and Christ Church remains one of the dynasty's greatest legacies.
He was the first real Christian king in the Viking world in Dublin. Now, his father was a Christian, but only a Christian for convenience. But his son, Sitric Silkbeard, was a real Christian, introduced Christianity to Dublin, went on a pilgrimage to Rome.
Sitric was the last great Viking king of Dublin. His death in 1042 marked the end of nearly 200 years in which the dynasty of Ivar had been power players. The age of the Vikings was over. Ever since, they have been remembered as savage raiders who plundered, killed, and enslaved, doing untold damage to society. But this is not the whole story.
Yeah, we owe an awful lot to the Vikings, completely in inverse to their numbers.
We often think of them as being barbarians. They weren't barbarians. They just had a completely different view of the world to the way that we would look at it today.
The Vikings shaped modern society in ways no one could have foreseen. Ivar and his descendants marched in the vanguard of this change.
There is a huge catalyst that they have in terms of the development of a network of towns, in terms of the development of overseas trade, and encouraging political developments that would have quite a long-term impact.
Before the Vikings came, there were no towns or cities in Ireland. Today, many of their settlements have become large urban areas.
And they did set up the urban centres and they did instigate commerce on a sort of an urban scale. And that's really the model that we still have today.
The interpretation of the Vikings has changed from being just a band of robbers, rapists and things like that. And we have got a more nuanced view lately, watching them more as traders and society builders as well as plunderers.
And they may have contributed even more. Groundbreaking research suggests that early medieval Ireland suffered a mysterious crisis, and the Vikings may have played a role in its survival. Rowan McLaughlin and Emma Hanna are researchers at Queen's University Belfast. By compiling and analysing scientific data from archaeological sites, they seek out the big picture trends that shaped history.
Archaeological sites are often just individual moments in time. What we can do is look at these over the long term by getting statistics from all these sites and modelling these data so that we can build up a continuous picture of how society evolved and how things changed from one century to the next.
Most of this data came to light during the 2000s, when Ireland undertook a major road construction programme.
The boom in motorway construction was a wonderful opportunity to look under the earth at what sort of archaeological sites were there.
Before the motorways were constructed, the planned roadways had to be archaeologically investigated, and large-scale excavations took place in areas of the Irish landscape.
Thousands of sites were discovered dating to all different time periods, but especially the early medieval period. And the material from these sites allows us to build up a picture of what happened in those centuries.
Using a high-tech radiocarbon accelerator, scientists analyze this material. The process is called radiocarbon dating.
All living things contain carbon, and a tiny fraction of this is naturally radioactive. So when a living thing dies, this radioactivity starts to slowly decay. And what the radiocarbon accelerator does is that it measures the number of radioactive atoms left in an archaeological sample. And from that measurement, then we're able to work out how long ago that living organism lived.
This method has been used to date over 10,000 radiocarbon samples from sites all over Ireland.
What we can do is gather all that data together and analyse it in a way that tells us about how things changed over time. We can build up density models of the fluctuating levels of activity and use that to determine how many people were alive in the past.
The calculations reveal something unexpected. The population of medieval Ireland experienced a sudden and dramatic decline.
What we see is this peak at around the year 700, and surprisingly, it declines. Now, we would expect a society that's evolving, growing, to gradually increase in scale and increase in complexity, but this is not what the data are showing us. Instead, there's a very, very significant decline.
Rowan then does a regional breakdown of the data, and this gives a clue to how Ireland survived the catastrophe.
When we divide our data, we see similar patterns in the northeast and in the northwest and indeed the southwest, this overarching pattern of steady decline. In the southeast, we see something different. The decline happens later, and it is not as severe as what we see elsewhere.
The southeast of Ireland, including Dublin, Wicklow, Wexford, and Waterford, was where the greatest number of Vikings settled. The Viking influx might just have saved a population in crisis.
The Vikings might have had a stabilizing effect on the decline. The average age of people is getting older and older, and so fertility rates will get lower and lower. When the Vikings arrived in Ireland, they came in, they were younger perhaps, they were certainly a lot more dynamic, and they were able to produce a real splash in Irish society at the time.
Hey brother, how are you?
And they created a long-lasting effect in Ireland, in its gene pool.
We can also see the long-term effects of this in the genomes of the present-day Irish population. We see a relatively large minor component of Norwegian-like ancestry in the genomes of modern-day Irish people. Upper limits put this sometimes at close to 20%.
The Vikings might just have saved Ireland. And the changes they brought still echo in society, not just in Ireland and Britain, but all across Europe.
I think Vikings have made a huge contribution to European culture, and you can see that in language, and you can see it in artwork, and you can see it in place names.
the way that Viking identities and founding narratives were really developed in the sort of romantic period of the late 19th century when people were undergoing this search for national origins, that the Vikings were built into those stories of the foundation of nations.
In some way, shape, or form, we are all Vikings.